support the repeal of this inhumane law. We need to get it on the ballot. So those of you that have petitions have a real high integrity question that you're facing. If you're sitting on it, you need to get it out from under your butt and get it in, because it won't be changed by the city council without a lot of signatures coming in. Whether we qualify or not, the number of signatures will make a difference.
All right, so get those signatures in to what address, David?
144 Belmont Street. I'm accepting them right at my home.
144 Belmont at David Silva's home, and you can give him a call at
429-5284.
429-5284,
now,
please.
Now, if you want to submit a check so we can help pay for...
check or gold bullion at the same address.
Gold bullion, so we can help pay for the homeless petition signature gatherers, and we have a professional person that was, just for 25 cents a signature, we had people out there, and we need to pay those people. Should I give our treasurer's phone number, or...
Well, why don't the checks could be given directly to you, and then you could...
No, I don't do money. I do signatures. Goes to Becky.
I see. Okay, well, why don't if you have a check, you give a call to 423-8529. There we go. 423-8529 is the number to call for.
Or extension 182 of the...
No, too many numbers. That's fine.
Okay.
429-8529. Actually... anything about the sitting band petitions or signatures or money, or if you want to help some more with the issue, or if you want to know what's going on, give me a call at 423-HUFF, H-U-F-F, and I will forward your call to the right place. That's an easy number to remember, 423-HUFF. Thank you, David Silva.
No problem. I hope, all these questions I raised, that it hit different people, and different people are interested in different issues, and they actually go and check out the supporting documents and ask the necessary questions, because that's what democracy is.
Thanks a lot, David.
Okay.
Well, that one lasted four times as long as I'd hoped. However, I, David, do appreciate this kind of a detailed analysis, and I guess I'm hoping that in the future we'll have winnowed it more before putting it out over the air, so those of you who have less patience than I will have not have tuned to KSCO in the meantime. But I do appreciate the help on this issue. There is no one in the community that knows these issues or is as sensitive to these that I know as David Silva. Well, we're still waiting for the Tenants' Rights Union of Santa Cruz to show up here in the studio because they did have a number of interesting issues that they brought out on the phone when I spoke to them yesterday. I talked to Warhorse Donna Dice, who has been fighting this fight at cost of her own personal peace of mind. They've attempted to evict her twice in a retaliatory fashion with the Tenants' Rights Union of Santa Cruz, and more is the amazement. She and Marco have successfully gotten city council support from Scott Kennedy and Mike Rotkin, to their credit, individuals I often criticize and would prefer not to see on the council, actually. But in this case, they're making the right choices, and I want to commend them for that. So that's positive stuff. We hope they come in, or at least one of them comes in. What I've got for you now is a little something from the conference that happened way back when, actually beginning of the month, in Sacramento. I went off to Sacramento to a housing conference, which actually had some talk about civil rights for homeless people. And we spoke with one individual. I hope I have the right tape here that I'm looking at. I think what we'll do is we'll play the beginning of the tape and then I'll introduce it. That'll be the approach.
Talking to Alicia Ogden here at the California Housing, or is it Housing California 98?
And indeed, that is Alicia Ogden. Alicia is an activist from Salinas, and we did, of course, a couple of segments on the Salinas panhandling law two or three months ago. Salinas now has a ask for a dime, go to jail for up to 6 months law in some areas. I think if you do it after dark, it's an immediate misdemeanor and crime. Santa Cruz, to its dubious credit, requires that you do it twice before it becomes a misdemeanor. Any request for food or money in Santa Cruz after dark is an automatic infraction, punishable by a $162 fine, and the second offense is up to 6 months in jail and a $1,000 fine. That's not like the second offense, like nagging or haranguing or abusing, but saying, excuse me, sir, could I have a dime for whatever? Could I have a dollar to buy a loaf of bread? Well, that's jail material. So you don't have to be Jean Valjean in Les Miserables to get jail for even just asking for spare change in Santa Cruz. So that is the Rodkin-Kennedy law. Same two gentlemen I spoke of earlier. Celia Scott wasn't on the council, and Catherine Byers, actually, I'm afraid to say, I have to say, Byers also voted for that law, which makes, I think, Byers shows that she's not right all the time, that's for sure. Let's hear a little bit about Salinas now.
I guess it's the 4th of May. Hi, Ali.
Hi.
And you're from Salinas?
Salinas, California.
And what's happening there with homeless folks? We know that your organization is not per se directly involved, but you are a connection with homeless rights groups there.
Yeah, there's an organization that's sort of an umbrella group for all the different homeless activist groups, and we do permanent housing, and they do linking people up with current shelters and trying to get funding for more shelters and more homeless services. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember the name of that organization because it's a long acronym, but...
It's around there somewhere.
It's in Marina. It's located in Marina, which is 15 miles from Salinas, and they cover the whole Monterey County.
Wow. You know, I often go through Marina when I travel south, but I never knew there was actually a group of homeless civil rights stalwarts who were ready to go out there and fight against such obscenities as the Salinas panhandling ban. Can you tell us something about that?
Actually, I don't know very much about the Salinas panhandling ban.
Indeed. Well, actually, it's one of these little laws that makes it a misdemeanor to ask for spare change after dark. Did you know that if you say, can I have a dime after dark downtown, that's up to 6 months in jail and a $1,000 fine?
Well, if they want to pass that, then they should have more places for people to go after dark so they won't be on the streets asking for money then.
Well, it's actually kind of an enlightened law, which sets up the jail building business, gives the homeless places to stay behind secure, barred areas so they can't be attacked by bigots from the neighborhoods. And it also provides jobs for workers who are trying to, you know, increase the housing facilities, albeit somewhat stark, of Salinas.
Yeah, I've got to support those institutions, even if they're prison institutions, I guess.
Let's not be soft-hearted or soft-headed about this. The only good homeless person is a jailed homeless person. Anything you want to add, Ali?
No, I just think there's a lot of good models out there. Maybe Salinas could be keeping their eyes open, looking for other models of homeless programs that are...
Tú hablas español también, ¿verdad?
Sí, hablo español.
And you've actually volunteered to do a little translating of this strange-looking Alert San Diego stuff, this California Homeless Civil Rights Action Network literature. Have you worked with Spanish for a while? Or?
I majored in Spanish, and I lived in Spain and Mexico and traveled through Guatemala, and we're a primarily Hispanic organization, so even though I'm not a native speaker, I work with native speakers that can help me out if I get stuck.
Good. Now, you'd say farm workers are a large percentage of those affected by anti-homeless laws, let's say, in Salinas?
Definitely. We have people living in caves, cars, makeshift lean-tos on farmers' lands and just public land in general because there's no housing.
What kind of a town is Salinas in terms of how does it get its money? What is its primary business or industry? Is it, I guess, agricultural?
Agriculture is the biggest industry. It's a $2.2 billion industry, but they somehow can't afford to pay their workers a living wage, and so they end up living, like I said, in caves, or they have three or four families living in one house, or they're homeless, and there's not enough in the way of emergency shelters or transitional shelters. There's no longer the labor camps that they used to have because they made stricter laws so they would have better living conditions.
All for their own protection, of course.
Well, right. There are stricter laws so they have better labor camps, but instead of having that work and benefit for the farm workers, what it did is the farmers just shut down the labor camps altogether because they didn't want to pay to improve the living conditions. So now there's nothing for the single male migrant farm workers, let alone for the family farm workers.
John Steinbeck wrote about that in, what, Grapes of Wrath from the mid-30s, right?
Yeah, well, it hasn't gone away.
it's with us today. It's a form of preserving history, sort of a historical preservation act. We're trying to protect our heritage, which is the poverty of the past.
Right. Rather than getting rid of the poverty, they're building a couple million dollar monument to John Steinbeck. It's currently under production. It'll bring in tourism, just what Salinas needs, is
more
people.
You're referring to Steinbeck Plaza, correct? Something like that?
Yes, there's some monstrous new ugly building going in to John Steinbeck's honor. I don't think he'd be too honored by it, though.
This actually was admitted by, I think it was either council members or some business witnesses to the in the panhandling debate, as to the reason why they wanted to have a law making it illegal for people to peacefully ask for spare change. We're not talking about a law which harasses you for pursuing or aggressively annoying, although those were partial provisions of the law, but the significant provisions had to do with the fact that just asking after a certain time of day becomes a crime. I assume, unless, of course, you're a person in a business suit ringing the bell for Santa Claus or United Way, in which case I would wonder if they would cite you, but who knows? I mean, even Santa may not be welcome on some Salinas streets, because there has to be, you know, organization, there has to be limits to the kinds of bummery that we're going to tolerate in Salinas. Wouldn't you agree?
Not really.
I see you're part of the problem rather than the solution. I will be reporting you to your local police. Anything you wish to add?
No, not really. I think we've covered it all. There's just a big need still for more money to go into all sorts of housing issues, from emergency shelters up to home ownership.
How large is Salinas? How many people live there?
It's about 120,000 people in a county of 350,000. And the
Monterey County.
Monterey County. The west coast part of it, the Monterey Peninsula, is totally tourism. Carmel, the median priced home is almost $500,000. And you can see how affordable that is.
How many shelter spaces are there for poor folks? I should also add, how many SROs have been destroyed in the last 30 years in terms of downtown hotels that you know of?
I don't know. I know that they're actually building a few SROs right now.
These are Mondo Condo, or is this for low-income folks?
Low-income.
Ah.
But I guess there's been problems with it in the way it's been done, and there's, I'm not sure what the problems are, but they haven't filled it up because of financial problems. I guess the SRO isn't quite low enough for the low income.
Uh-huh. What about shelters? How many people, let's say, are sleeping illegally in Salinas each night that you're aware of? How big is the homeless population in Salinas?
I think it's about 4,500. And in Monterey County, I believe that's from Monterey County. And the shelters are mostly run by churches. I don't think there's anything done by the government, per se. There's no public housing,
really?
Emergency shelters, as far as I know.
Are there laws against sleeping in your vehicle or sleeping outside in Salinas, as far as you know?
I don't know.
Well, of course, we'll be coming back to you to get a full report in about 24 hours to get the information. We want to thank you, Alicia, for your good work. Anything you... We have a comment from some hysterical woman over here. She wants to make some comment. Yes, what is it? We want to thank you again, Alicia, and anything you want to add?
No, that's all. It was my pleasure.
All right. Thank you, Alicia Ogden.
And that was Alicia Ogden at the Housing 98 conference up in Sacramento at the beginning of the month, talking about Salinas and what's happening down in Salinas, sister city to the south. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. In Santa Cruz, call in here is 423-5361 if you want to make any comments on anything you've heard or bring up subjects regarding civil rights for poor people or police misconduct or current events around the political process that you think we should be talking about. It's your radio station as well as ours. It's 423-5361 for a very simple way of putting your voice on the air, so you're not just thinking gruffly in your own house, stalking about, or feeling frustrated on your own, but you're actually beginning to share your thoughts and feelings and opinions with other people in the community and getting some feedback on them and letting people know maybe you're not the only one who has gotten a sleeping ticket, maybe you're not the only one who's been treated abusively by the police, or maybe you've been treated properly and you have a positive experience you want to relate, whatever. Give a call to 423-5361. We're going to be on the air for the next hour here at Bathrop Spears Broadsides on 96.3 FM. If you want to contact Free Radio Santa Cruz off air. And if you're interested in a show yourself, or you want to donate money, or you're interested in helping out the station is desperately looking for a place to stay where it can afford the rent. The voicemail number is 427-4523. Email is at Free Radio Santa Cruz, FRSC actually, at cruzio.com. And the address by snail mail is Post Office Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. You can send us your PSAs, loop tapes, demo tapes, information you want broadcast on the air. Again, Post Office Box 7507, Santa Cruz, 95061. Or just leave a message on the voicemail, a minute or two in length, 427-4523. Well, lots of talking. Maybe it's time for a little singing. Getting a little tired of all these political topics, perhaps. Let's hear from some of those old-time religion folks, it being Sunday. At least they were kind of part of my religion when I was younger.
Oh, the time will come up when the wind will stop and the breeze will cease to be breathing. Like the stillness in the wind for the hurricane begins, the hour that the ship comes in. Oh, the seas will split and the ship will hit, and the sand on the shoreline will be shaken, and the tide will sound and the waves will pound, and the morning will be breaking. Oh, the fishes will laugh as they swim out of the path, and the seagulls, they'll be smiling, and the rocks on the sand will proudly stand the hour that the ship comes in. And the words that are used for to get the ship confused will not be understood as they're spoken, for the chains of the sea will have busted in the night and be buried on the bottom of the ocean. Song will lift as the mainsail shifts and the boat drifts on to the shoreline, and the sun will respect every face on the deck the hour that the ship comes in. And the sands will roll out a carpet of gold for your weary toes to be a-touching, and the ship's wise men will remind you once again that the whole wide world is watching. Oh, the foes will rise with the sea still in their eyes, and they'll jerk from their beds and think they're dreaming, but they'll pinch themselves and squeal, and they'll know that it's for real the hour that the ship comes in. And they'll raise their hands saying we'll meet all your demands, but we'll shout from the bow your days are numbered. And like Pharaoh's tribe, they'll be drowned in the tide, and like Goliath, they'll be conquered.
That's Peter, Paul, and Mary, a song from the mid-60s by Bob Dylan, When the Ship Comes In. And when will that be? That's my question. Well, Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 is what you're tuned to, and our phone lines are open at 423-5361. Also picked up some interesting stuff from the papers and also from the internet. Portland, Oregon, up north, has been kind of keeping an eye on not only what we've been doing around the Sleeping Ban Initiative, but also what its sister city to the south, Eugene, has been doing. Eugene actually, as those of you may know who've been listening to my show, passed a law making it legal for people to sleep in their vehicles in industrial areas. And that has been the case since November, and actually it passed a subcommittee headed by the mayor for a two-year extension. And so it's apparently not just an idea whose time has come and a plan that's been implemented, but it's also a plan that has had some justification and in practice, and it's coming back and is going to be repeated for a longer period of time. in Eugene. Why Santa Cruz can't follow Eugene isn't clear. Why we need a citizen initiative to make it legal for homeless people to sleep at night when we have less than 30 shelter spaces, that's floor spaces on the floor of the Interfaith Satellite Shelter Program's summer church program, is not clear to me. But here's a couple stories from Portland. Here's one, Homeless People Work Toward Campaign Success by Kaya Sand. On January 8th, Ramona Cowles lost her apartment. She set up camp in Forest Park with her husband, Jeremiah, carefully constructing a tent that did not disrupt the natural foliage. Each day, they carted out their garbage. On April 16th, the police tacked a sign on their tent that said, "Notice, illegal campground." On April 21st, the police stole their tent. Ramona and Jeremiah slept on the bare ground. On April 22nd, they slept in the rain. Ramona used a day's income selling the Burnside Cadillac, which is the homeless newspaper in Portland. Burnside Cadillac is like the street spirit in Santa Cruz or the street sheet in San Francisco. In front of Powell's, a location she shares with another vendor, George, to buy new plastic and poles, as well as launder their wet sleeping bags. She's saving her money to get an apartment and have shelter for her 14-year-old son, who is living with her adult daughter. And although she is determined to sell enough papers to rent a place, if I have to stand at Powell's day and night, she says, the sweep on her camp placed her in a much more difficult situation. She wasted 2 days dealing with the situation and a day's wages. And she is forced to fritter her energy on vigilance for further police action. The police occupy the precious time of homeless people with sweeps and tickets. People who might prefer devoting that time to coping with issues that keep them on the streets must spend it dealing with police-imposed problems. Ramona, a lifetime activist, would like to see Portland's anti-camping ordinance changed, and she's doing something about it. So far, she has gathered 300 signatures for the Campaign for Legal Places to Sleep, which seeks to present the names of 10,000 concerned Portlanders to City Council, demanding that the ordinance be repealed or amended. Volunteers have gathered about half the needed signatures. I think the general attitude about police cracking down on homeless people is that people are flabbergasted, said Ramona. There's no reason for it. Portland's anti-camping ordinance bars camping in public places. To camp means to set up, remain in, or at a campsite. A campsite is defined as any place where bedding, a sleeping bag, or other sleeping matter, or any stove or fire is placed, established, or maintained. Police generally include simply lying down. Which is also illegal 24 hours a day, thanks to our Downtown Association and the folks on Karen Gillette's Homeless Community Resource Center board, Donna Murillo and Linda Steinow. They led that campaign in 1994 here in Santa Cruz. This ordinance criminalizes homelessness in Portland, where there are not enough beds and shelters, and where shelters often come with strings attached. The campaign outlines a maintenance plan, which includes a sliding scale and work plan applied to people who use the designated spaces. This includes utilities, waste disposal, upkeep, and security. The campaign also seeks to have homeless people included in the decision-making processes regarding the designated zones. There will be at least one place where the police can't hassle you and you can get some decent sleep, said Ramona. The repercussions of the anti-camping ordinance are part of Marcus and Gabriel's daily lives. I think those are her children. On a Sunday afternoon, these are two new people. On a Sunday afternoon across the street from Saturday Market, the two men rest inside a cement structure. Marcus is crouched on his haunches, standing occasionally. Gabriel is not that limber. He is stiffly semi-reclined on his duffel bag. I'm disabled. It's kind of hard for me to get anywhere, said Gabriel. Several police bike by as we are talking. Marcus and Gabriel point out that without the buffer of a reporter, who appears not to be homeless, the police likely would have stopped and asked them to move on. At the very least, said Marcus, the police would have asked him to sit up. Lying down constitutes camping. They shuffle you on, Marcus said of Portland police. They say, you're no good. How do you think that makes a guy feel? In this town, it seems police have a real chip on their shoulder, added Marcus, who is from Connecticut, more so than other places in the country. Here it's, I'm better than you. Why don't you go get a job? Ramona, who studied sociology at the University of Oregon before the Reagan administration cut back financial aid, has some theories on police behavior. She draws from the sociologist Zimbardo, as well as Maya Angelou. Every human being has the same capacity when you are put in a position of power. You become the oppressor. When you are put in a position of the powerless, you become the victim or the rebel, Ramona said. She mulled this for a moment and then amended it. Somewhere we make a decision. people who like having power over people go into these kinds of jobs. That is why you see a tendency for those people to become unreasonable. People who have a more balanced nature have a tendency to avoid these jobs. She also points out that for some police officers, faulty reasoning blurs the difference between homelessness and the so-called war on drugs, and sweeps and searches are an attempt to confiscate drugs. The myth is, if you are homeless, you use drugs. You choose to be out there, said Ramona. I think they are really going after drugs and alcohol. If you want to fight drugs and alcohol, don't harass people who are homeless. Don't make it impossible to survive. Recently, Ramona was ticketed for blocking the street and being a public nuisance. She was up against a building wall talking to a friend. The police blocked the 12-foot-wide sidewalk for 20 minutes with their large horses to ticket her. When a cop is hassling someone just for personal entertainment, he's got lousy boundaries. He's breaking human laws, Ramona pointed out. Here's an aside from Santa Cruz. I'm reading this article from the internet and the Portland campaign for legal places to sleep, part of the campaign for legal places to sleep going on up there now. Santa Cruz has the same kind of police situation where police gather in great numbers to engage in harassment. I mean, I've seen this as recently as 2 days ago, where on Friday afternoon, a man sitting on a bench at, I think it was Cedar and Pacific, talking to a fellow on a bicycle, and police, four or five police had gathered to check everybody's ID because of a dispute. It wasn't a fight, it was a dispute. And the their IDs were being held and continued to be held, even though people were saying, you have a right to take my ID, the police didn't answer. Police will actually do what you give them, what you let them do often. They'll search you if you let them search you. They'll take your ID if you let them do that. They'll ask you questions without informing you of your right to an attorney often if you don't, make it clear that you don't want to say anything. In this situation in Santa Cruz, when I came up and I had my tape recorder and I was recording all this, and I may be playing it later in the show, the police officers, one of whom was an officer with a German Shepherd dog who walks around the mall, that's Officer Brandt. I don't know what the name of his dog is, and I don't mean to badmouth the dog, although I certainly wouldn't want him to badmouth me, that's for sure. There was a kind of, again, they were all set to continue this. They had there were two squad cars, a bicycle, again, four or five cops checking IDs for people who were essentially, had to do with whether a bicycle hadn't moved down out of the red zone. And we're going to be hearing, by the way, some interviews of people on the mall soon here in Santa Cruz. They'll give you some actually direct testimony about how police are conducting themselves downtown, or some police officers anyway, around the mall. And when I said to the officers involved, and I said to the people involved, look, you don't have to give them your ID, and you don't have to identify yourselves at all unless you're accused of a crime. Unless there's reasonable suspicion for a detention, you can just tell them to go on your way, or perhaps, as one individual has suggested, take me to a magistrate if you have a problem. And when that was said, suddenly the IDs started coming back from the police who were on the mall. And the point is here that as long as the community tolerates incursions on basic civil rights, police will do it. And it's not because police are bad people, it's because they see that as the most effective way to do their job. I mean, they want to take pictures of every young person on the mall, and they want to put them on lists so that they can cross-index them with potential suspects here and there and so forth. Their job is to suspect anybody scruffy and grubby of criminal behavior. And perhaps people who aren't scruffy and grubby of criminal behavior, they're looking for to solve crimes. And they're also, unfortunately, looking to enforce a sort of, not just standards of behavior, I'd say standards of existence, on behalf of the merchant community and the conservative political community downtown. So, for example, obviously, non-criminal behavior, like sitting down near a store, within 10 feet of a store, has become criminal behavior, which means, of course, you can't sit anywhere on the mall virtually. With certain exceptions, and those exceptions will soon be gone because all the building is being done, and they've removed the benches from areas of the mall, so you have a few benches you can sit on. And actually, ironically, the guy that was his ID was being taken was sitting on a bench, And the point was, of course, to intimidate people, to frighten them, and thought they might have some old warrants, to make them more tractable to police direction, even if the direction was unconstitutional or inappropriate or biased toward a particular, toward their merchant bosses. And I say that because it's the merchants who dictate the agenda downtown in terms of how people on the street are treated. That's been made clear with the city council surrender of the downtown ordinances in 1994. And since then as well. So again, getting back to the situation in Portland, we're reading this from this article. So it was the police themselves that blocked the sidewalk and caused the problem and created the difficulty, according to this this author. Police blocked the 12-foot-wide sidewalk for 20 minutes with their large horses to ticket her. When a cop is harassing someone just for personal entertainment, he's got lousy boundaries. He's breaking human laws, Ramona pointed out. People living outdoors in Portland are up against a catch-22. To not allow a police officer to search her, Ramona said, she has to fear retaliation. If one of my kids was in school, I would have told them not to let the police search them. When I had a house, I wouldn't have let the police in. My person is my place now. The last thing you have left is yourself. And after all the little trappings, the person is the last thing left. I don't care who you are or what your social position is. You exist, so you have a right to dignity and personal space, she continued. That needs to be recognized by everyone. Police sweeps carve apart the dignity and personal space. Ramona suggested that many people are skeptical that change is possible because the system has failed them time and time again. But she believes the campaign for legal places to sleep will make a difference. I've seen things get changed, said Ramona. I've been a part of getting things done. To find out more about the campaign for legal places to sleep, contact the Burnside Cadillac at 503-228-5657. Now, Burnside Cadillac is not a used car dealer. It's the name of a newspaper. And a Burnside Cadillac is, of course, a shopping cart. That's what they call it up in Portland, whose large street Burnside bifurcates the city up there in Oregon. And that's on the Internet. Came off... about a, I don't know, 2 or 3 week old story. Interesting stuff. Lots of interesting stuff in the media recently, too. Sometimes we follow the drug war. And you can hear from this last story why we follow the drug war. Because folks on the streets are most directly impacted by it. It also, of course, affects you folks in houses because... they can come in, confiscate your, not just any herbs you have lying about or any medical marijuana that you're using, but, you know, eventually confiscatory laws let them confiscate your property if you're engaging in any kind of druggish behavior. Or druggish behavior, that's really not the word. If you're using a substance that affects no one but you, but the police now have expansive powers. And of course, they make all kinds of mistakes. And we've heard numerous instances of police actually killing the wrong people, breaking into the wrong house and so forth. And this whole story is so grim and sad and familiar that it doesn't need to be repeated here. But California has taken a different stance toward medical marijuana with the passage of Proposition 215. And I've been following here on the radio the recent counterattack by the federal government, which got Judge Breyer to uphold, essentially, not quite uphold an injunction, but to tell the clubs, six clubs in Northern California, that they couldn't proceed. And that's still being fought, but there's actually more bad news. The San Francisco Cannabis Club, run by Dennis Perrone, kind of reorganized under a new ownership with a woman named Hazel Rogers. And they were attacked last week, and there's a story in the San Francisco Examiner I'm now going to read you about that. Pot Club to Fight Closure Ruling. Judge Tells Healing Center to Shut Its Doors in 5 Days by John Lynch and Eric Brazil. Sounding a familiar refrain in its fight to provide medical marijuana to the sick and dying, San Francisco's Cannabis Healing Center vowed to remain open and resist a judge's order to shut in 5 days. Ruling that it is a public nuisance, not a primary caregiver, authorized to provide marijuana to people with AIDS and other illnesses, San Francisco Superior Court Judge William Cahill issued a temporary restraining order Thursday afternoon, that's 3 days ago, demanding the club's closure. The ruling came 3 days after a U.S. district judge ordered 6 Bay Area cannabis clubs to shut, saying federal drug laws supersede California's voter-approved Proposition 215. Cahill's ruling only applies to the San Francisco club. A lawyer for the cannabis club pledged to fight the ruling, saying that if the order is not reversed, patients and volunteers might resort to civil disobedience should authorities try to close them down. It could get very ugly, said attorney J. David Nick. Dennis Perrone, founder of the center's predecessor, the Cannabis Cultivators Club, said he is braced for anything. Are they ready for another Waco, he asked, referring to the Texas obliteration of the Branch Davidian cult in an FBI assault. Are they stupid enough to do that? Yes. In his written ruling, Cahill said Hazel Rogers, 79-year-old director of the Pot Club, does not qualify as a primary caregiver of about 6,000 AIDS patients and others using the drugs for medicinal purposes under Proposition 215. Cahill ordered the sheriff to evict the center tenants at 1444 Market Street within 5 calendar days and to change the locks. It's another move on the chessboard, said Lynn Barnes, a registered nurse and volunteer spokeswoman for Californians for Compassionate Use, also headquartered at the club. Our lawyers will be going back to court Friday, that's day before yesterday, to halt this action. We think we can get this action delayed. I attempted to contact Dennis Perrone's office this morning and wasn't able to get through. Of course, it is Sunday, but the club, I think, is often open at different times. So we don't know if they were able to get it to stay on Sunday or what. But their number was not disconnected. It just rang, and it was about 9:30 in the morning, about an hour and a half, 2.5 hours ago. The San Francisco, we will be open tomorrow, she said Thursday. Nick said volunteers and patients may feel compelled to take very severe measures to resist orders from being carried out. 100 to 200 patients handcuffed inside the building, he said, people in wheelchairs, locking hands. I think the Attorney General should think very hard if he wants that kind of thing. Cahill argued that Rogers' new outlet was not that different from the one operated by Perrone at the site. Perrone stepped down and turned the reins over to Rogers after the club closed April 20th, following another series of court battles. Cahill had denied State Attorney General Dan Lundgren's first request for a temporary restraining order against the center April 28th. At Thursday's hearing, Lundgren's deputies filed new affidavits in which drug agents said they bought marijuana from the center. Nick said drug agents should not be allowed to use phony documents to buy medical pot, but Cahill rejected his arguments. Oakland Cannabis Buyers Cooperative officials thwarted a similar effort Thursday. Executive Director Jeff Jones announced at a press conference that a DEA agent had tried to slip in to buy marijuana using a fake driver's license and doctor's recommendation. The long-haired man wearing camouflage pants and a t-shirt with a conspicuous pro-pot design in front presented identification as Brian Zanzi, but Jones said he believed this man to be Brian Nearing, refused to sell to him and ordered him out. Pinned inside an elevator by a pack of reporters and TV camera operators, the man kept his head bowed and his hand over his face and refused to respond to questions. A DEA spokeswoman, Jocelyn Barnes, confirmed that an undercover agent went to the pot club on Thursday. DEA will continue to monitor all the pot clubs, and that will include a full range of techniques, including underground purchases, Barnes said. And this is an article in the Friday San Francisco Examiner, Pot Club to Fight Closure Ruling. And we're not quite sure what's going on up there, but that's the most recent story I've read, and I wanted to pass it on to you. Any thoughts on this? Give me a call, 423-5361. Have you suffered harassment because of your use of medical marijuana? Let's hear from you. Hi there, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Can barely hear you.
Okay, hang on. You're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Robert, how you doing?
Good. Are you listening to your radio caller?
No.
What you need to do probably is turn on your radio. Can you do
that? Well, I can hear you fine now.
Okay. Well, the problem is that if we do it this way, we have transmission problems.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. I should tell this to all callers. If you're calling, try to keep your radio on. Unlike other stations which have a delay, we don't have a delay. And it's more helpful for us if you keep your radio on.
Go ahead. It's on.
Okay. So...
Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay. So, caller, what can we do for you?
Well, I wanted to get some comments from you about the Karen Gillette matter.
Oh, wow. Can you be more specific?
Sure. There's been a burst of publicity regarding Karen Gillette's resignation and then withdrawal of resignation and terms regarding the merged board that's Tehachapi Community House recently. Karen Gillette being what, the director of the, what's the name of her organization?
The Homeless Community Resource Center?
Right, okay. Just to pull some stuff out of the Sentinel, 5/22/98, Gillette withdraws resignation. But Gillette determined that comments made privately about her mm-hmm. by a few Citizens Committee for the Homeless board members indicated that she would have a problem working for a merged board that might include some of those people. What do you make of that?
Well, actually, if you've been listening to the show, you probably heard a few of my comments. Karen Gillette has been the, well, main person running the Homeless Community Resource Center, the head of it, in fact, and its predecessor, the Free Meal, since 1990. Actually, the Free Meal started in 1990 when Karen Gillette took over, actually kind of did a little coup behind the back of the previous Free Meal manager, who was a homeless activist named Jane Immler, whose Hunger Fast established the River Street Mini Shelter and the actual property on which Karen Gillette's, it's actually not the same property. It's right next to the property Karen Gillette was on, but it's the property that her Free Meal was on before she moved it onto the property it's now on. Anyway, she has been sort of the city's fair-haired girl or woman running the program, and she's done some positive things for homeless people, no question about it, in terms of services. She was able, I think in conjunction with demonstrations by homeless activists that she bad-mouthed at the same time, she was able to encourage the police department to open up the property where Community House is now situated about 5 or 6 years ago, so there was a place for people to sleep. She's been successful in maintaining the Free Meal, expanding services, as I guess David Silva mentioned earlier, to include lockers and phones and laundry and jobs, services. Certainly not enough, but certainly better than we had before. Again, in conjunction with activist activity, she sort of became the safety valve for the city, her program. And her program is a very positive one, and it should be commended for and supported. The problems that have developed in her program have to do with, some claim, cronyism. They have to do with the fact that she really has taken a severe hostility to some activists, like myself, and she literally spread rumors that jeopardized us physically. They claimed that we were trying to close down her meal and so forth. And originally, she had a very bad grievance process. Linda Edwards, an early activist, was circulating a petition for better food. There have always been claims that Karen Gillette's staff takes the best cuts of the food and everybody else gets the lesser stuff. That's something I've heard actually repeated recently. But again, these are, you know, I mean, there are, that could well be true, it could be false. But in terms of the specifics, the problem has often been with Karen, as I mentioned while David was on the air, David Silva, is that her process of management, really, she doesn't want any critics in any position of not just power, but even so they're visible and audible. For example, on her board, she would not allow public to attend her board. And I fought this for several years because I thought, as a matter of principle, board meetings should be open. I didn't really find her board meetings that interesting when I read the agendas afterward or heard about what was going to be talked about, but I thought as a matter of principle, they should be open to the public. And not just a matter of principle, I thought the Brown Act was also involved. Well, she claimed, no, we're not getting, we don't have a publicly appointed person on our board, therefore we don't have to open them to the public. Well, she's getting plenty of public funding, and my thought is, if you got nothing to hide, why are you closing your board meetings? And, some people may write this off as some kind of personal, tiff between me and Karen. I thought it was a principled issue. And I also felt that it had to do with a bad policy of management, whereby Karen kind of made choices for her homeless clients without having much input from the clients, and no process for critics. Now, it is true, and she should be given credit for the fact that she has a better process for grievances than the Citizens Committee for the Homeless, which is the board that her Homeless Community Resource Center is going to merge with. They actually had a process, mainly because I objected and demanded there be such a process, for a woman who she or her staff threw out of the Homeless Community Resource Center, and she came and presented it to a subcommittee of her board at in a formal process, which is as it should be. I'm not going to comment on whether I feel there was a just result or not, but at least they allowed for that process. So there's a mixed bag with Karen. But in terms of the specific situation that you're mentioning, there has been a plan to merge the Citizens Committee for the Homeless, which is running this multi-million dollar community house project, which I have long lambasted as a big boondoggle, as a big piece of a way of getting a lot of money for providing very few limited services. I mean, it's sort of another halfway house thing, which funds middle class positions and pays for, it has the whole theory that it's not the housing problem, it's all these poor mentally ill drug alcoholish type folks that need programs. I mean, certainly people need programs, but I felt for a long time that people also need emergency services that they're not getting, that are being constantly ignored here. And I'm thinking particularly of the right to sleep at night and a campground to camp in, obvious things the city has ignored. So what's showed up in the papers recently is apparently there was going to be a new super board. There was going to be a merger of the Homeless Community Resource Center and the Citizens Committee for the Homeless. Not a complete merger, because they both want to keep money coming into both groups. It's required. You have independent groups, so you won't get as much money from the feds. But there would be kind of a combined board, and Karen would be the head of the new, she'd be the head of Community House, she'd be the head of her existing program, which is right next to Community House, which is the Homeless Community Resource Center. She'd be head of all this. And there were some people on the Citizens Committee for the Homeless board who had some criticisms of Karen. They were in the minority. They would not have prevailed. They made those criticisms at board meetings that were open to the public, because CCH board meetings have largely been open to the public, with some exceptions. And she didn't like what they said. And frankly, some of the things I heard, I didn't like either. I mean, there was talk about drug use, which I think is completely irrelevant. Karen smokes marijuana. So what? So do I. So does everybody else. And so should everybody have the right to do. And as long as it doesn't impact your performance, there should be no problem about that. And that's not...